You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
Today is Thursday, February 16th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, David Dayen on how that auto bailout went in Michigan. He's a Michigan native. Also, Jeff Smith on Occupy Wall Street, the bus tour, Black Bloc, and other sundry Occupy Wall Street updates. Also on the program, drones. We're going to just see so many of them. They're going to be like flocks of... If you don't have the opportunity to see geese flying over overhead, you'll have the opportunity to see up to 30,000 drones in the skies in the coming years. Also, Virginia, it was once just for lovers. And now, of course, it's for state-mandated vaginal penetration by medical devices, or maybe soon to be, if the Republicans... The Virginia state legislature has always been, like, very close to ground zero for the whack jobs. Maybe it is, the ground zero for the whack jobs. I'm not sure. Also on the program, a treasure trove of emails from a corporate whitewash outfit. You could characterize it as essentially a money laundering front for corporate global warming denialists. I mean, I don't know if that's a legal term, and if it is, in that case, it's something different. But it really appears basically money goes in. It's like what I do with the homework with my daughter, where you get those functions. This number goes into the machine and it comes out and it's a different number. And these emails, we will talk about that as the show progresses. But just to give you a sense of just what kind of anti-union, we're going to talk about Romney and his perspective on the auto bailout, because it's essentially playing on anti-union sentiment. But just to give you a notion of just how anti-union the establishment is in this country and the mainstream press, I'm going to read to you an article that was in the Politico, and we'll put a clip of the picture up here. Milwaukee, and you remember this story that President Obama was in Wisconsin yesterday, and apparently Scott Walker was supposed to show up with him, but he got the flu, because that flu can just hit you like that. So President Obama is at the Master Lock Company, which is a union shop and has brought back, I think, 100 employees from China back into the United States. Dateline, Milwaukee. It's very clear what side President Obama is on here in Wisconsin. Behind the stage where he will speak today are two flags. An American one, as usual. And right alongside it, and just as large, a flag for the local union, Wisconsin 1848. The president has been mum in recent months on the battle raging in the Badger State between unions and Republican Governor Scott Walker, who's facing a recall election largely pushed by labor after he pushed through laws effectively taking away collective bargaining rights. And this sleuthy reporter, Donovan Slack, actually, maybe it's a fake name. I mean, Slack. Has mistaken the Wisconsin flag, which has a picture of working men of olden times, I guess, a sailor and a miner. Below a badger. And, of course, the number 1848, which happens to be the year the state was founded. Alas, not the number of a local union. Politico has since pulled down the story, but it just gives you a notion of just how anti-union the establishment is in this country, just how anti-labor, and how far Politico is willing to go to create a story. I imagine there is an opening right now at Politico if you're looking for a job as a reporter to cover such things. If not, that is one of the saddest testaments I've ever heard to modern journalism. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to David Dayan. Ladies and gentlemen, we are back. The Majority Report on the phone. It's always a pleasure to welcome to the program David Dayan of FireDogLake.com, the news section. I say this every time you come on, but it's equally as true. I just don't know how you manage to write as much as you do and as well as you do and report as well as you do.
Sam, I appreciate the praise every time I come on.
Well, I appreciate your appreciation of that. This is really great. Now, I wanted to bring you on to talk about Mitt Romney's latest in Michigan. And on some level, this is a story of the campaign, but it's also a story of, I think, one of the most successful aspects, one of the most successful moves that Obama made in attempting to salvage the economy in the wake of the financial crisis. And, of course, you are are you a native Michiganer?
No, I'm not. I went to college there.
Oh, okay.
I went to college at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor.
Well, yes, that part I knew. For those of you who are just joining this program, David and I were in a student film together.
That's right.
You know, it must have been 20 years ago now.
Sadly enough, it was that long ago.
It was probably closer to 18
or
19.
You weren't from Michigan. You were brought in.
I was brought in
As a ringer actor on the film.
That's right. My best friend was at Michigan Film School. And oddly enough, my wife went to school with them in that in that same year in the film program. I didn't meet her when I was out there any of those times.
Really?
Yeah. It was a weird moment when we sort of realized that.
Funny how that works.
It is funny how that works. All right. So just give me, you know, if you can, just give us some background on what the auto bailout was and what Mitt Romney's sort of lame and feeble critique of it is.
Right. Well, you have to actually go back to the Bush administration because the auto industry was basically failing in 2008. It was already going through some troubles before the financial crisis, and the financial crisis and the ensuing recession just destroyed demand. And so these companies were on the verge of bankruptcy. And we're talking about particularly GM and Chrysler, and to a far lesser extent Ford. And so the Bush administration actually gave some bailout funds to those companies. And then when Obama came in, he needed to come up with a plan, a larger plan, because what the Bush administration had done was not going to be enough. So what he eventually did was, I guess, what would be called a managed bankruptcy, allowed the companies to go into a restructuring, used public funds to sort of guarantee and backstop that, worked out some deals between the unions and the companies, and gave them the conditions, to come back and succeed. And this protected, you know, really millions of jobs, because it wasn't just about GM and Chrysler, but it was about the entire supply chain, all the auto parts and all the small distributors, as well as auto dealers all across the country. So really, you were talking about millions of jobs.
Now, people have to understand something about this situation, is that there was a lot of calls at the time saying, let them go bankrupt and restructure.
Right.
And there's two things that people need to know about bankruptcy. And full disclosure, I think the guy who's actually the lead bankruptcy attorney for GM, I think he was at my bar mitzvah.
I knew it.
Yes, of course.
You've been...
To go into bankruptcy, and my father's a bankruptcy attorney, it's basically one of the only things I know, is that you need to get essentially a bridge loan, which will fund your proceedings there as you are protected from your creditors. Now, for something this large, the problem is that if GM and Chrysler, let's say, or just GM, had gone into bankruptcy, creditors would have been held off. You've got a lot of small companies. That means that they have no cash flow. They're used to getting money on a 30 or 60 day or a 90 day turnaround from GM, and they're getting no cash. And a lot of these guys wouldn't have been able to sustain themselves. Plus, you have consumers who are going to say, I'm not going to buy a GM pickup if I don't know this company's going to be around in 3 years.
Absolutely.
Because
and there was no money available in the private markets.
Exactly.
For GM or Chrysler to access. It was just not there. Now, Mitt Romney at this time was one of those people saying, let GM and let Detroit go bankrupt. In fact, that was the title of a New York Times op-ed that he wrote around this time, when the decision was being made, saying let Detroit go bankrupt. And after the fact, now what he's trying to say is that, well, the administration did what I said, they just didn't do it right. But what Romney was asking for was that no public money be even put up for risk at any point along the process. So he was saying, put GM into a quick bankruptcy, a quick rinse bankruptcy, without determining, you know, what the funding source would be for that bridge loan. So it would be impossible to pull off what Romney claims now that he wanted to do.
And on top of that, you know, the idea of going into a quick bankruptcy is, a lot of times what you'll have in these situations is, before you go into bankruptcy, your representation will go and will essentially make deals with all your creditors. So that at the moment you walk into bankruptcy, you've already you already have those deals in place, and then you can turn around and come out of bankruptcy very quickly. They could not do this again with GM because you're talking about thousands of maybe literally a couple of thousand creditors, and just the the actual time involved in that. You could not do one of those type of managed bankruptcies that would have happened so quickly without this notion of essentially the government backstopping all these deals.
And so in Romney's mind, the government made the mistake of actually hiring people to go through that negotiation process. Like, the problem was that he actually designated people to work on this problem. In one respect, that is what Romney's saying.
And now Romney's also attacking, sort of, he's using this tact of attacking the unions here. And by saying that essentially Obama came in and gave part of the companies to the unions, which is really a bunch of BS, because it was part of a union deal where instead of getting cash to fund their pension accounts, explain that.
Exactly, yes. There's a thing called the VEBA, which was this trust fund that was put together mainly for union health care. And it was the union's money, right? I mean, it was this cash that was supposed to go back to the union members. So that was swapped in exchange for an equity stake. And the equity stake is predicated on whether the company does well or not.
Right.
If the company does well, and we've seen GM did do well, and today they announced their profits, and every union member will get $7,000. And I'm sure this will become this huge point of contention on the right, that now the greedy union members are getting payoffs. But the truth is that if GM didn't do well, then the hit would go to those same unions and the same union members. So it's far riskier to take an equity stake than it is to take a promised cash payout, which is what they had at the time.
Right. They would have taken the cash payout, but GM and Chrysler had
GM
no cash.
Right. They didn't have it. So they went to this equity deal, equity swap. And, so that's hardly giving away a stake in the company. That's trading cash on the dollar for a far riskier bet.
Right. And I don't know. It just seems like, it's the proverbial skin in the game that we hear Republicans keep talking about over and over again. You got the unions basically putting on the line: if we don't deliver as workers for your company, we're going to pay. We're going to pay
the
for the implications of that.
And what happened was is that they did deliver for the company. What we're seeing is record profits from GM. We're seeing Chrysler move forward and slowly get out of some of their troubles. Ford had already sort of cleaned themselves up. And we're seeing the auto industry come back and support a real jobs resurgence in the state of Michigan, who's seen their unemployment rate drop several points. One of the faster growing states in the nation in terms of getting its job situation under control.
And now the U.S. government still owns about 25% of the company in terms of stock. Is that right?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
And essentially just waiting for the stock to rise so that they can get the best sort of bang for the buck, I guess.
Right. And I think everyone agrees that that's going to happen. And Romney's argument here is really going to be a hard one to pull off, because he's essentially saying to the team that's just scored, seven touchdowns and is up 42-0, that he doesn't like the way their uniforms look. I mean, it's really a strange thing that saying, this was the plan and it succeeded, but it was done in it wasn't the way I would have done it.
That's right.
That's really this carping after the fact that is incredibly unattractive when a politician tries to do that.
It's just so funny. If you guys had just maybe thrown some more screen passes, it would be 45-0 right now.
Exactly.
All right. So I cannot let you go without giving me your sense of the financial foreclosure or the mortgage settlement deal. You were, I think, the one of the first people to report, if not the first, that the deal didn't really exist yet in terms of any way that we could know. Is that still the case?
Yeah, it still doesn't. I mean, we are a week out. A week ago, this deal was announced. And to date, we still do not have a term sheet. We don't have the actual specifics of the deal. And we're told that the state and federal regulators are not going to give the actual details until they file it in a court. There's some injunctive relief that is done through the deal. So the deal has to be blessed by a judge. But until that time, they're not going to release the terms of the settlement. And so we're all here kind of looking at executive summaries and press releases that have been put out, and everyone says they're on the deal, but we haven't seen what the details are. And everybody knows that if you enter into a contractual obligation with somebody, the details matter, and they matter a lot. And with every 49 state attorneys general already signing off before the terms are made, while we have an agreement in principle but not in fact, they lose all of their leverage to actually make sure that the obligations that are in these press releases actually get borne out in the details of the deal.
So have they signed off? I mean, so for instance, like today, okay, and I'm sure you saw this. You probably have already written a piece on it, because it's past 6 a.m. in the West Coast. But there was a piece by Gretchen Morganson in the New York Times.
Yeah.
The audit in San Francisco County. Well, just tell us about that. But I got to imagine that when that comes out. Well, tell us about it, and then tell us what you think maybe that's what the implications are
right.
on this.
Yes, I have written a piece on that today.
It's
Phil
King,
who's the assessor recorder of San Francisco, did a fairly cursory investigation of the documents that are in his recorder's office. He looked at 400 foreclosures over 2009, 2010, 2011, and he found that 84% of them had at least one irregularity in the documents. And these were actually serious irregularities, not just robo-signing, but things like where the owner that was named in MERS, which is the big electronic database where mortgages were transferred, didn't match the name of the owner on the documents.
That's just paperwork.
That's just back office stuff. Serious issues. And serious deficiencies that were found by Phil Ting. And it was just 400 documents. I mean, what's been amazing through this process is that the players with the smallest authority or the smallest perceived power have been able to find the most thoroughgoing document fraud throughout this process. And essentially Phil Ting is a register of deeds. He's a recorder.
Yeah, you get the sense that he was just sitting around the office and he just said, I'm just going to...
Let me just
Margaret, will you just hand me the files, like those ones on the desk there? Just hey, I'm going to... I got nothing to do this afternoon. And he's just going, oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Right.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
What you find in the few registers of deeds who have done this is that they've found their offices to be crime scenes.
Yeah.
They've found the physical evidence just sitting around in their offices because eventually the foreclosure documents have to go back to the recorder. Most of it is done on the cloud, as it were. It's done in this MERS database that is extremely vague, all the transfers. But once you actually foreclose on someone, you kind of got to let the county know. And then when they get those documents back, they find them to be riddled with errors.
Well, so let me ask you this. So this happens, this gets into the New York Times. It's happening in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And Kamala Harris has already signed on to this deal. Does this type of story coming out, does this put pressure on her to get even more aggressive? Does it make her think twice? I mean, if there's no document, there's probably no signature quite yet. And I know that, do you think that the terms of this are still in play? And in a situation like this, it may end up actually helping homeowners in the sense that she might be pressured into pressuring it more, or she lost all her leverage because in the press she said she signed off.
I think the deal should be still in play, but I don't think it is. I think when these guys signed off and they extracted what they wanted to extract, in Kamala Harris's case, to get billions of dollars, or at least the perception of billions of dollars for constituents. In Eric Schneiderman's case, the perception that he preserved certain suits. By the way, I mean, Phil Ting's investigation would help Eric Schneiderman in this securitization working group. Some of the problems that he found are directly caused by securitization and securities fraud. He found that in many of the documents, what was listed on the foreclosure document was completely at odds with the representations that were made in SEC documents to mortgage-backed securities investors. It's the securities fraud that Schneiderman claims to want to investigate.
Correct me if I'm wrong here, but that's also what I think it was Carl Levin's committee found, that both the people who are securitizing these mortgages, the bankers that were securitizing these, were basically telling their clients lies as about what was in it, and then also lied
about
the
origination, about the underwriting, about the accuracy of the document. Yes, absolutely.
So let me ask you this: do you think Schneiderman sold out? Do you think that he thinks he made a good deal? Do you think that it's too early to tell? I mean, what is your perception of it?
I can't get in his head. I think that he, you know, perhaps believes that the political dynamic has shifted a little bit, and he has some opportunity to use federal resources, federal jurisdiction, as we've talked about on this show, to get an investigation going that takes sort of the best of both worlds, the best of what he can do in his position in New York and the best that can be done at the federal level, to do a really major investigation that would show that this settlement was just sort of a down payment. That's the term that he uses on homeowner relief, where they can get maybe hundreds of billions out of a further investigation when they show this exposure. Now, whether or not he'll be able to do that is far from certain when you're talking about him being the co-chair on a panel with other federal regulators who probably should be investigated themselves.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, when you're talking about a guy like Robert Guzami, who was the general counsel, he's now the head of enforcement for the SEC, but he was the general counsel at Deutsche Bank when they were a securitization trustee and making a bunch of dodgy deals, the idea that he's going to turn around and then investigate his peers just does not seem credible to me. But
to be fair, wasn't that the whole story of Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid?
That's true.
Know,
I should look back to fiction.
It's not like there isn't some precedent in the movies for something like that.
Exactly.
To
the extent there's going to be anything done, it's going to happen because there are people like Phil Ting who are, continuing to put pressure on and embarrass the state and federal regulators by doing the investigations. It's going to be because activists are still talking about this and demanding justice and accountability. It's going to be because people don't, basically
let it
pack
drop
up and go away after the settlement on these minor issues, or this minor settlement on actually major issues, is done. That's what's going to get us to a better place here, is by continuing to put pressure on the people who have the ability to do the job.
David Dayan from the news section at FireDogLake.com. Thank you so much. I think Atreos wrote this, but I can't point to any single individual who has been more dogged on this issue than yourself.
Thank you very much,
and I appreciate hearing from you. All right, thanks, David. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Jeff Smith of Occupy Wall Street media team, and also the guy responsible for us losing couple members. So, but we're going to be talking about what's the latest in Occupy and continue on with this conversation, this debate that has been going on in Occupy Wall Street about black bloc tactics, about violence, and more. We'll be right back after this.
Make you lose your mind.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the award-winning Majority Report, best political podcast of 2011, and you know, I may just call us the best political podcast 2012. It's early, but I think we definitely have the pole position here. And on the phone is Jeff Smith, of part of the media team at Occupy Wall Street. Jeff, as always, welcome back to the show.
How you doing, Sam?
I'm doing good. Are you still on the bus, or are you off the bus now?
I'm finally off the bus. I parted ways in Buffalo with the bus, and they went on to Pittsburgh, which is where they are right now still. So it was about a week and a half, or 11 days, I think, total. So I got plenty of time with, you know, my bus ride with the Black Bloc, so to speak.
Really? Is it the Black Bloc bus? Or are you just talking about it?
Yeah, no, it's just, you know, like we talked about before, I think what we had in the bus was certainly a large representation of not so much the parody of what a black bloc is, or sort of the caricature that's been painted out there, but actual, you know, what self-described anarchists. And they were talking a lot about what Chris Hedges had written and what Graeber had written, and the whole controversy. And it's become definitely a hot point of topic all over the upstate area. Every city we went to, we talked about it. So it's definitely out there, but I think I got, you know, in some cases, perhaps the best perspective, because I got to talk to these people for literally hundreds of hours out there, and sort of came to a different conclusion than I think has been out there.
Well, let's talk about that. And I should say that last week, you know, I had read a piece from Jesse LaGreca, who basically asked people not to wear masks for transparency's sake. And someone had written me and just wanted me to clarify that Jesse LaGreca was not responding to you. He had written it. It was something that he had written, I think, more in just in general response to the conversation that was going on. And last week there was a sense that you were calling for violence, I guess, or I don't know. You had somehow tainted the show with your bussitude, or you terrified my daughter Myla. She liked you, but you did become very, very aggressive with I'm joking, of course. But so, all right, so give me your sense of what you've taken for me. And I should just also add that I interviewed Derek Jensen yesterday for next week, when I'm going to be on school vacation. And he was quoted in the Chris Hedges piece, and he had some very interesting things to say about it as well. But I want to hear what your perspective is on this.
Well, you know, like I said, I think the idea of diversity of tactics, which has really always been a part of the language of Occupy Wall Street, is just about the fact that, you know, the decision to be nonviolent, which has largely been the decision thus far, always presumes that, you know, you could be otherwise. And so rather than, you know, literally telling anyone what their definition is of violence or not, because I've come to realize when you are, you know, Muslim in this country and you're families from Iran, or if, you know, you're black or brown in New York City, you have a very different experience than other people. And to tell them that A or B is nonviolent, you know, is a bit counterproductive, I think. And that's sort of the agreement. But anyone that explicitly calls for violence, you know, that's something else. And the whole point of it there is to make it explicit that, you know, anyone that is interested in that should be on board. And that really hasn't happened at all. And so any of the activity that's so-called black bloc or more confrontational even with the police thus far has been in situations like, I mean, you saw when the kettling nets were taken away from the cops. I mean, that's essentially a black bloc technique. I wouldn't call that violent. And, you know, anytime the crowd is able to unarrest someone, let's say, I would also not necessarily call that violent. But it's being mistaken with some one person deciding I'm going to throw bottles at cops or I'm going to smash windows. And that's just not going on. That's not part of it. So the idea that theoretically you could do that, yeah, that's there. And if they want to have a meeting where they're going to all say, we're throwing bottles at the cops, then I'm not going to be there. And everyone better know that, you know, anyone that wants to call Occupy Wall Street that effort is, you know, shouldn't do that. But I'm not really here to tell anyone exactly what they can do. I think that I feel comfortable in the environment of community where people are open with each other. And what we saw at Zuccotti Park was exactly that same scenario, where there was kind of a community agreement, and people that were interested in doing things that were violent or you know, against what that community agreement were sort of self-censored in a way that was pretty remarkable. But I think that's what you have to do, is you have to turn over the trust to the group to allow this model to work, and that it has been very, very effective so far. So,
do you think that, not talking structurally now, but within that structure, do you think that people are still self-censoring themselves that way, or is there? Do you think that are you perceiving, at least in terms of you know, people talking about it, there's been a change?
No, I mean, I think really it feels like this entire topic may have been something designed to break the movement apart in some way and to cause us to focus on it instead of the real mission at hand, which is, you know, finding ways to, you know, attract people's attention to the banks and the other financial crime and government fraud, et cetera. And so, you know, I have to wonder whether this, you know, flame being fanned is just another technique in some case.
But you don't think that Chris Hedges or Jesse LaGreca are attempting to are interested in dividing the movement, do you?
No, I think that it may have just happened accidentally. I'm not sure exactly what motivated Chris Hedges to write that piece, but certainly once, you know, that spark was lit, I think it was very easy
right.
to fan that flame and to make this a topic, because frankly, it seems like an effective tool to tell certain Americans that if you go there, it's going to get violent and you'll be, you know, arrested, or you could be hurt or involved in something that you want to be involved in. And I think it really is not the case. I think what I'm saying is that the movement is exactly the same now as it was many months ago when
right.
people called it completely nonviolent, and the language of the movement continues to be 100% nonviolent, you know. And so I'm just, you know, the only issue of diversity is that theoretically it could be violent, otherwise we've already, you know, given up in a sense.
Right. I mean, frankly, the you know, I still contend that even in the parts of the civil rights movement that we do not associate with violence today. I'm not even talking about you know, Malcolm X and the Nation of Islam, but even within the context of the movement that we associate with Martin Luther King, there were people who would be on the stage with him who were advocating more aggressive, more violent tactics. So I think, you know, there is, it's impossible to speak of a movement anywhere where that sort of implicit threat, even if it doesn't take place, is not part of it and shouldn't be part of it. It's interesting because, you know, Derek Jensen was saying, I think, and, you know, this is maybe a sort of a crude summation. It was an hour-long interview, and he's a fairly interesting guy. But he was basically saying, like, I believe in diversity of tactics, and that, but I don't think that, you know, throwing and I don't think he was accusing anybody of doing it, but he's saying, like, you know, throwing a bottle through a window, I just don't think is an effective tactic. You can still believe in the notion of diversity of tactics and still think that certain things are not even tactical. So it's definitely an interesting development. And I have to say that I liken it to, the off-season talk with the Red Sox. You know, people want to stay engaged, and so they find a topic to talk about. And I'm not even sure that it's, you know, how relevant it is. I don't know that anything, you know, there are always sort of outlier incidents. But speaking of liar, let's talk a little bit about in trying to sort of sully the Occupy movement. I'm sure you've seen the video of Andrew Breitbart having a sort of a what I think some people could call an acute mental breakdown episode out in front of CPAC. And just give me your sense. I mean, he put out a list of supposedly 17 rapes. We've talked about this in the past. They've been debunked, at least the vast majority of them. And to the extent that any existed, it turned out to be people from outside the movement, essentially attacking people inside the movement. But give me your sense of if you think that's going to have any resonance, or is this just sort of intramural?
Well, I think, you know, I have seen the video. I think I've seen more of, it's sort of like some other videos have had this effect, but I've watched other people watch the video many, many times. And so it's definitely, I just think Occupy Wall Street drives the Fox News crowd insane because their tricks don't work against it. You know, I mean, there are certain people that it resonates with, and Fox News just has no play with those people in any right. sense. So they just look at it and they just laugh at it. They're like, who is this, you know, old drunk guy? Why is he yelling? I mean, it's most of the people that have watched it don't know who Andrew Breitbart is, don't know what he does. You know, so it's really funny to just see someone having a tantrum because, you know, he likes attention, and his other, you know, ploys have certainly gotten such a rise out of, you know, the left wing or the MSNBC crowd, and Occupy Wall Street just doesn't care, you know, and I think that's kind of the lesson to learn about how you deal with these guys.
I saw I happened to flick through and see Cenk Uygur on the Young Turks interviewing Andrew Breitbart, and I literally for a moment thought, like, oh my God, somebody broke into the studio and Cenk has sort of talked them down. and then I realized, oh, it's Breitbart. Boy, he really looks like he's on last legs in terms of, you know, before one takes a unplanned vacation, you know, for relaxation and R&R. So what can we expect, turning to more, sort of maybe perhaps relevant issues, what can we expect, in the near, future, from Occupy? We've had some great success stories about saving some homes in Atlanta, and I believe one in, Memphis or in Tennessee, I think it was. Occupy SEC came out with by all accounts is an incredibly, well-studied and well-written 300-and-some-odd-page comment on the Volcker Rule as public comments are being taken. What else is in the works?
Well, I think that there's sort of two things going on here. One is that you're seeing a real residual effect of the initial Occupy Wall Street direct action that's been replicated all over the country and has now essentially created new hubs of activism throughout the country. And they're going to continue to do work, and you will hear about these efforts, and even other groups that maybe didn't have as high a profile are now connecting with what is called the Occupy movement. And then you also have, I think now, many of the people that were part of the original planning and other people now that have joined on, the sort of, you know, really most motivated, most creative people are back into the planning mode right now. And so one of the targets certainly is a May 1st action, a May Day action that has been in planning virtually every day now going forward until then. And just passed through the GA. It was just sort of a consensus upon, you know, it's not a call for a general strike, because that's not legal in this country anyway. And so it's more of a call in solidarity if people want to have that kind of action, essentially a no capitalism day, no economic activity day, and just personally abstain from buying things or going to work or however you want to participate. And I think you're going to see all sorts of different actions all over the country, all on that same date towards, you know, whatever that group's personal goal and vision is. I mean, what I think I've learned so much in this group of people is just the realization that there are different goals for different people in terms of what this movement's about. And success is sometimes just about personally feeling good or feeling some sort of liberation personally. And I think that's what made Zuccotti Park such a revelation as a direct action, is that people would just come there and feel good, and it was liberating and empowering to them. And that was itself. So when they said, what's the goal? What do you want to change? It wasn't about that. It was just about, you know, giving people a feeling that then now they can go forward with. And so, you know, when you listen to what you talked about with Michelle Alexander, you know, when you think about how marginalized some people are in this country, they should have the right to, you know, figure out the way that makes them feel good too. And I think that's what this is about. So that's really also how I sum up the diversity of tactics in that conversation. But I think you're going to see, certainly once the weather gets warm, it just enables more and more people to get into the streets, and that allows for even more tactics and more things that can be done. And so that's what I think is important. It's not so much the timing anymore. Time will come. You know, people need to be patient. These movements do take time, and, you know, everything takes time, really. And so that was really Obama's most salient skill when he ran for president, is that he seemed to have a great sense of pacing and time, and that made him quite successful. So I think we need to – that's the one element that I think we might take from
the president. Well, yes, Jeff Smith, sure, from the Occupy Wall Street media team, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Tim.
All right, talk to you later. Folks, you thieves. You managed to steal another 8 minutes from me. God. Look at yourself in the mirror. Are you in your car right now? Are you listening to this podcast in your car? Well, I hope you're driving to the police station. And I want you to go into the police station, and I want you to walk up to the desk, and I want you to say to Sergeant McMurray, or Sergeant McDonald, or Sergeant O'Reilly, or whatever the name of the sergeant is in your small hometown police station, say, "Officer, I have stolen an extra, well, now 8 minutes and 39 seconds of the Majority Report podcast. Please lock me up." And hopefully the sergeant will say, in a, you know, first-generation Irish accent, "Look, here, I have the internet. And you can just go to majority.fm and become a member now, and all is forgiven." And then everyone will be happy. It's a wonderful story. Coming up in the better half of the show today, Virginians for Vaginal Penetration. Also, on Denial Gate, Drone Gate, Private Prison Gate, Anonymous Gate. If you have the opportunity, folks, please head over to Majority.fm and take our survey. It is for a potential advertising service, and it would be very helpful to us. Also, if you buy crap through Amazon, go to support the show at the top of the Majority.fm page. Click it. You'll see the Amazon button. Click that. Bookmark it. You'll never have to do another thing again. When you buy your Amazon crap through that link, we get a kickback. It helps. It helps. Also, justcoffee.coop, coffee, tea, chocolate, fair trade, organic if you want. 10% discount with the coupon code Majority. Heading to the better half, call us 646-257-3920 or IMS at Majority FM.